I'd like to talk today about a man named William Still, Philadelphia, and the Underground Railroad. What I'll try to do is to revivify the Underground Railroad in its symbolic and its political importance to Philadelphia. What Underground Railroad narratives represent in spatial terms, I'll argue, is the advent of a new African-American communal narration of space. It represents resistance as a form of citizenship. And while telling individual fugitive stories, the literature of the Underground Railroad reassembles them into a larger social narrative. However, before discussing the roles of William Still and the Philadelphia Vigilance Community in creating such spaces and narratives, let's turn to the paradigmatic moment when Harriet Jacobs first approached Philadelphia in September 1842 aboard ship from North Carolina, having escaped from confinement in a loft crawl space for 7 years. Philadelphia presented a prospect of personal freedom, unlike anything she had ever experienced. Jacobs arose with a woman friend, went to the deck, quote, to see the sunrise for the first time in our lives on free soil. She writes a poetic apostrophe to freedom using the nature imagery of a sunrise glimmering over glimmering water, but fear quickly infuses the passage. Quote, before us lay the city of strangers. We looked at each other, and the eyes of both were moistened with tears. We had escaped from slavery, and we supposed ourselves to be safe from the hunters. But we were alone in the world, and we had left dear ties behind us, ties cruelly sundered by the demon of slavery. This moment of first sight of Philadelphia appears repeatedly in escape narratives. The confusing wonderment of the city of Philadelphia appears comparably in the narrative of Levin Tillman, a fugitive slave arriving by boat from Delaware, who writes of waking to find his ship at dockside, whereupon, quote, I stood gazing, my mind being filled with wonder and astonishment, partly bewildered at beholding the strange scenes and listening to the buzz of a crowded city. The drays were dashing along the wharves, and the masts of the gallant ships to me looked like a forest. However, I soon felt a peculiar anxiety to go ashore, to satisfy my mind in observing the curiosities of a large metropolis. End quote. For William Craft, a fugitive who arrived at night in the disguise of his light-colored wife's servant, arrival in Philadelphia provides a moment of salvational ecstasy. Quote, late at night, or rather early in the morning, I heard a fearful whistling of the steam engine, so I opened the window and looked out and saw a large number of flickering lights in the distance and heard a passenger in the next carriage, who also had his head out of the window, say to his companion, wake up, old horse, we're at Philadelphia. The sight of those lights and that announcement made me feel almost as happy as Bunyan's Christian must have felt when he first caught sight of the cross. End quote. To arrive at Philadelphia for many fugitives from slavery was to arrive at the advent of a new life. Their emotions of arrival and freedom rapidly subside into concern over how to find shelter, food, further passage northwards, and livelihood. Together with these imminent daily struggles about to begin in the City of Strangers, Jacobs and her companion arrived to a situation of social isolation that communal social assistance could only partly ameliorate. The contradiction between Jacob's human need to escape further victimization versus her desire to live together with her children, mother, and extended family displaces her even further from this new world. As a fugitive, she arrives through social compulsion. As an emotional being, she arrives in a state of deprivation and devastation. caused by separation from her children. Alienation continued to haunt Harriet Jacobs as she walked through the city. Quote, I had never seen so large a city or been in contact with so many people in the streets. It seemed as if those who passed looked at us with an expression of curiosity. End quote. The reason I dwell here on Harriet Jacobs is in order to employ her as one model of fugitive consciousness in the cosmopolitan space of Philadelphia. Someone surprised and a little intimidated by the city, even as it was where she gained a greater degree of freedom than ever before in her life. There enters another force, a communal force, that operates to provide her refuge, assistance, and further transport in this new space. While staying with the family of Reverend Jeremiah Durham, a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, Jacobs quickly received a visit from a member of the Vigilance Committee. She writes that while sitting alone in an upstairs room, meditating on, quote, great shadows from the mournful past, end quote, Mrs. Durham entered to request she join them because there was, quote, an anti-slavery friend downstairs who would like to see me. Jacobs continues her description of a home interview with the Vigilance Committee. Quote, I overcame my dread of encountering strangers and went with her. Many questions were asked concerning my experiences and my escape from slavery. But I observed how careful they all were not to say anything that might wound my feelings. How gratifying this was can be fully understood only by those who have been accustomed to be treated as if they were not included within the pale of human beings. The anti-slavery friend had come to inquire of my plans and to offer assistance if needed. Jacob's family had provided sufficient funds to sustain her, and she declined assistance. Her fugitive traveling companion accepted the Anti-Slavery Society's offer of expenses to New York. 5 days later, they departed northwards in a crowded Jim Crow train car. Jacob's first encounter with segregated public transport in a northern state, and, as she said, a very disagreeable ride. Jacob's narrative describes a routine encounter with the Vigilance Committee and its outcome from the perspective of a fugitive. However, what she also describes is the reception she receives from Philadelphia's African-American community of the historic 7th Ward, a community that W.E.B. Du Bois was to document over 50 years later in The Philadelphia Negro. The 7th Ward, bounded by Lombard, 5th, 8th, and South Streets, and centered around the Mother Bethel AME Church at 8th and Lombard Streets, was a center of Underground Railroad activity. During the decade before the Civil War, over half of the city's population lived in the 7th Ward, comprised of the Moyamensing, Southwark, and Cedar neighborhoods. Of the approximately 90,000 fugitives who escaped on the Underground Railroad, a substantial majority joined the free black communities of New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Rochester, and Boston, with significant numbers of arrivals in Philadelphia beginning about 1820. The attractiveness of these communities for fugitives lay not only in opportunities for economic survival, but in being able to remain concealed within a dense urban population. This was a feature of the city's geography that had been developing for generations. In 1800, Philadelphia consisted of 0.08 settled square miles. By comparison, New York occupied 1.5 settled square miles and Boston 1.2. The effect of this condensed residential pattern was to drive population density to very high levels. Half a century later, in 1850, the settled area of Philadelphia proper had expanded to only 2.3 square miles. The city's population stood at 129,000, and its population density had soared to over 52,000 persons per square mile. There was varied distribution of this population since the wards bordering the Delaware River, including the 7th Ward, rose to densities of over 90,000 per square mile, while the western wards had many empty lots. Outside of New York City, And despite William Penn's desire to create a green country town, there was no more densely populated area on the North American continent than the Philadelphia River wards. Some fugitives chose to remain and blend into an African-American community numbering approximately 20,000 at mid-century. Others joined the long-standing free black communities of southwestern Pennsylvania, as did Henry Franklin, born in Maryland as Bill Budd, who became a draysman in Quakerstown and an Underground Railroad agent. Despite providing sufficient density to establish new identities and disappear into the Seventh Ward, Philadelphia remained a risky geography for African Americans because slavery was close enough to constitute a hazard. Walter Hawkins, a mid-1840s fugitive who was to become a Methodist bishop in Canada, found that although Philadelphia, quote, was called a free city, kidnappers were ever on the alert to recapture slaves who had taken refuge in it and send them south again, end quote. Friends told Hawkins that the spirits, as slave catchers were called, spirits were on his track and reward bills were posted everywhere, so for the period of his stay he kept indoors for the most part and never went out at night. The previously mentioned Levin Tillman was recaptured in Midtown by a mob in the Bull's Head Bar off Chestnut Street when they decided he was a likely fugitive. John Thompson, who together with a friend was a fugitive in the city, recorded, quote, "We had not been there many days before his friend was met and recognized by a lady in Chestnut Street, but he feigned ignorance of her and did not answer when she addressed him. He came directly and told me of the affair, which at first gave me great alarm. But as we heard nothing more from her, our fears gradually subsided. My friend soon married, and not long after moved to Massachusetts, whither he was driven by one day seeing his old master in one of the streets of Philadelphia, peering into the face of every colored man who happened to pass." Various accounts also exist of the kidnapping and enslavement of black children, especially by boats that found children at the water's edge. Peter Still, William Still's older brother, reported tens of cases of child kidnapping. George Lippard's Philadelphia novels, The Quaker City or The Monks of Monk Hall, published in 1844-45, or the less well-known The Killers, a narrative of real life in Philadelphia, published in 1850, were based on real incidents of secret Philadelphia life that included white-on-white kidnapping, rape, murder, and gang warfare, all taking place in a mysterious underground city geography. Fugitive narratives emphasize that we must reimagine this violent Philadelphia cityscape as a multiracial encounter. Indeed, we might ask how Lippard's radical literary imagination of violence was influenced by the violence visited upon the black community. For Philadelphia's blacks, the risks of violence were compounded by the manifest racism of the city's public sphere, for which there is an antebellum chronology too long to review beyond a few examples. 1829 saw the first anti-black riot in the city, occasioned by anti-abolitionist sentiment, with even more serious outbreaks in 1833, 1834, and 1842. In 1838, white mobs burned down Pennsylvania Hall, newly built and in the midst of its inauguration ceremonies as a national center for the anti-slavery movement. In 1842, there were 3 days of riots as whites attacked the Seventh Ward and burned the Second African Presbyterian Church, together with a community hall and a black temperance hall in Moyamensing. In September 1849, there were anti-black street battles led by the white nativist Moyamensing Killers, battles that caused fugitive and Underground Railroad activist James Williams to leave Philadelphia temporarily to avoid arrest for his involvement in the Stringers, a black street gang fighting the Killers. As he spoke at an abolitionist gathering in Norristown in 1852, there was an attempt to lynch Frederick Douglass, by wrecking his train as it passed through Manayunk. When the Methodist minister and former slave John Dixon Long moved to Philadelphia in 1856, he reported that in, quote, the city of brotherly love, to my astonishment, I found prevailing a vast deal of pro-slavery sentiment. Even as late as December 1860, anti-abolitionist public sentiment caused Philadelphia's mayor to press for cancellation of the annual anti-slavery fair. Not only was the state the enemy of African Americans and fugitives, but so too were the majority of white Philadelphians. It was in this antagonistic social environment that Philadelphia's black underground emerged, an underground that would have profound consequences not only for the thousands of fugitives who came northwards with its aid, not only for Philadelphia's African American community, but for the public sphere of the city. The Underground Railroad, in which Philadelphia was a primarily black organization operating with strategic assistance from a small group of heavily Quaker whites, was a form of civil resistance as well as humanitarian assistance. Through the means of the Underground Railroad, African American citizenship functioned covertly to subvert and undermine the legal structures that held them subordinate. Moreover, and crucially, because the existence of the Underground Railroad and passage of fugitives northwards was well known throughout the city during the 30 years prior to the Civil War, the open secret of the railroad, and it was an open secret, stated that the black community was able to defy slavery, to defy slave hunters, and to defy the law in order to claim freedom. More than any other American city, largely through the efforts of William Still and his colleagues, Philadelphia retained a public memory of the acts, stories, and effects of the Underground Railroad. Well, now let's turn to the role of William Still in challenging Philadelphia's public sphere dominated by racism and pro-slavery sentiment, and then to his collection of narratives in The Underground Railroad. Beginning with his employment in 1847 as a clerk at the Philadelphia Anti-Slavery Office and its less formally organized Vigilance Committee, William Still was as centrally located an operative as existed in the Underground Railroad. When the committee reorganized in December 1852 after a period of poorly organized aid for fugitive slaves, Still became its secretary and the chairman of its acting committee, charged with daily assistance duties. In this capacity, he managed the traffic flow of fugitives arriving from southern states, participated in committee interviews of newcomers, obtained hidden shelter and funds, provided food and clothing, arranged for the fugitives' next transport along the railroad, and maintained a voluminous correspondence. While Still never identified fugitive hiding places in print, many of these, particularly for fugitives arriving by water, were undoubtedly in the Seventh Ward. Throughout his career as an Underground Railroad agent, accomplished at significant personal risk and under legal threat, Still kept notes hidden in a basement wall. Still's 1872 book, The Underground Railroad, the only one he published, resulted from those notes. Entirely underwritten by subscriptions from within the African American community, this 780-page volume is the great compendium of escapes from slavery prior to the Civil War. It is nearly unique in American witness literature for the extensiveness of its retelling of slave escape stories, for its intimate knowledge of escape routes and methods, and for the narrator's direct involvement in aiding large numbers of fugitive slaves. The interviews of the Vigilance Committee, as transcribed by Still, provide graphic narratives of the geographic negotiations accomplished by fugitives. These narratives emphasize the extent to which Philadelphia's African American Society provided temporary haven amid the transformative experiences of modernity. Crucially, this is a literature that emphasizes the negation of isolation. Isolation being one of the central experiences of modern cosmopolitan space, as reported by Jacobs, Tillman, and other fugitives. Still's work as a organizer of the Underground Railroad lies precisely in that negation of isolation and the organization of an illegal subterranean society in response to a radically oppressive society. Underground Railroad is a volume that merged slave narratives, the encyclopedia, and business reports to create an adaptive hybrid genre that answered to the practical conditions of African American life. Underground Railroad represents interracial and communal resistance to slavery as a unified totality through third-person anecdotal narratives, first-person narratives, case intake notes and interview transcripts, committee meeting minutes, letters, testimonials, biographies, court transcripts, legal decisions, newspaper articles, tracts, pamphlets, report abstracts, and reproductions of wanted notices. Everything has been thrown into this narrative. Although Still and his single major work commonly appear in African American histories and literary histories, there have appeared only two critical articles entirely dedicated to the book in its own right. Such minimal, and it must be emphasized, minimal treatment of an entire compendium, in essence, it's the first African American encyclopedia, originally rose, no doubt, from early historiography of the Underground Railroad as the creation of white abolitionists, an understanding that fed off the many post-war accounts and autobiographies published by white authors. William Still, however, provided no sustenance for any account that minimized the overwhelming black presence in operating the Underground Railroad. More recent scholarship has provided intellectual, political, gender, and religious perspectives on abolitionism. But the mass of local detail in Underground Railroad has continued to resist interpretive readings. The Underground Railroad provides opportunity for prolonged discussion as African-American witness and travel literature both. Despite its uniqueness as the most comprehensive work to emerge from an anti-slavery vigilance committee, as noted above, the Underground Railroad has received minimal attention as narrative. It has most frequently been treated as a source book and guide reference to the Underground Railroad, its incidents, its personalities, so forth. This is very much the sort of anecdotal use predicted by an Atlantic Monthly Review of the 1883 second edition, where it suggested, quote, "Here is a book which contains an inexhaustible fund of anecdote and suggestion for the future novelist who wishes to use, as he will be sure to, incidents of the struggle between freedom and slavery. There is no more human appeal in literature than these annals make." End quote. Dramatization of incidents is a first step in romantic appropriation, however, and Still was profoundly anti-romantic. The volume was a record of daily life in the anti-slavery underground, and his encounters with fugitives were frequently enough quite grim. That grimness appears in the detail of an intensely dense text, one that includes separate sections of intermixed fugitive-related literature and genres assembled on a loose, thematic, and roughly chronological plan. These 244 sections include 212 fugitive narratives, three letter sections, two legal sections, one historical and one organizational section, and 24 biographical sections that constitute a biographical dictionary of the anti-slavery underground. There are over five dozen engraved illustrations of scenes and personages on 44 black and white plates, making this one of the most profusely graphical of Underground Railroad books. A few sections are no more than a paragraph's length. Most are 2 to 4 pages, and some run to approximately 20 pages. The major divisions are a series of largely dramatic and better-known fugitive narratives at the outset, mostly concerning one fugitive or a large party, the arrivals reports constituting a thick, chronologically organized midsection, and activist biographies at the end. Beginning with the Seth Conklin narrative, which relates the murder of an abolitionist rescuer of the enslaved family of Peter Still, William's older brother, narrative method proceeds on the basis of cumulative exemplification of cases and persona. In greater or lesser detail, the volume reports the cases of over 590 fugitives. In his capacity as Secretary of the Vigilance Committee and Chairman of its Acting Committee, beginning in December 1852, Still managed the traffic flow of fugitives arriving from the southern states. Fugitives desperate to find or rescue their families often wrote to Still as a hub of information, an unofficial social worker for the fugitive committee throughout the 1850s, and he got correspondence from as far as Canada and even further. In consequence, Still, who took verbatim notes of interviews to maintain committee records, acquired extensive files and correspondence. Philadelphia was a frequent first entry point for fugitives traveling up the Atlantic coast, particularly from southern port cities, from Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware, and Still was frequently their first Underground Railroad station agent. As Still notes, however, the committee's work was only part of the Underground Railroad and its extensiveness in Philadelphia, for, as he says, quote, the little aid actually rendered by the committee was comparatively insignificant compared with the aid rendered by some who were not nominally members. The Philadelphia committee functioned as only one agent within this far larger network of fugitive assistance. With the impetus of the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, similar vigilance committees arose in port cities of New York, Boston, New Bedford, and Bath, Maine, as well as inland locales such as Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Cincinnati, and Oberlin, which was a particularly spirited anti-slavery community, and many other towns and rural areas with a vigilance tradition. Still was a businessman. By the 1872 publication date, he owned and rented properties, operated secondhand clothing and manufacturing businesses, had established a successful coal yard business, and would, in 1888, become the first president of the Berean Building and Loan Association. Thus, Still sought to frame his book as a record of passengers, railroad agents, and the business of obtaining freedom. He disclaimed any literary purpose for this 780-page volume. He writes, in the use of these various documents, the writer begs to assure his readers that the most scrupulous care has been taken to furnish artless, underlined artless, stories, simple facts, to resort to no coloring to make the book seem romantic, as he is fully persuaded that any exaggerations or additions of his own could not possibly equal in surpassing interest the original and natural tales given under circumstances when life and death seemed about equally balanced in the scale, and fugitives in transit were making their way from slavery to freedom with the horrors of the Fugitive Slave Law staring them in the face, end quote. Further, he assures readers that the writer is fully conscious of his literary imperfections, end quote. The time allotted him from other pressing duties is, moreover, exceedingly limited. End quote. Quite similarly, Abolitionist Robert Smedley writes in his history, using the third person for increased distance and self-reference and assume neutrality of authorship, that, quote, he has endeavored to glean only well-authenticated facts, unadorned by the glowing colors of fancy, which lend such charm and fancy to many descriptions of adventures, end quote. Anti-slavery fiction established itself equally as grounded in factuality that sought to overcome artifice. Prior to the war, anti-slavery writer Mattie Griffith asserted in her 1856 pseudo-slave narrative, Autobiography of a Female Slave, that it represented, quote, sincere narration of stern fact, end quote, and that she had witnessed all incidents of her novel. Another anti-slavery writer, Elwood Greist, who at nearly the same time as the first edition of Still's Underground Railroad published John and Mary, or The Fugitive Slaves, a Tale of Southeastern Pennsylvania, a novel of the Underground Railroad, felt constrained to state in his preface, quote, the following story is founded on facts that come within the personal knowledge of the writer. The characters described are all real ones. The narrative is founded strictly on facts. Even an explicit fiction of fugitive slaves represents itself as entirely within the domain of factuality. It's facts here, ma'am, just the facts. Although a critic like George Parsons Lathrop from the Gentile tradition could write, ours is essentially a period of prose, he decried literalism, quote, mere transcription of facts, aspects, and phases actually observed by the writer is, we find it necessary, notwithstanding its self-evidence, once more to announce neither artistry nor anything approaching it, end quote. Lathrop's prescriptive aesthetics limited artistry to his own literary preferences. It would be more accurate appreciation to understand post-war chroniclers of the Underground Railroad, such as Still, Smedley, and Greist, as subscribing to a theory of literature as a prosaic, fact-driven, realistic rendition, where participants in recent history provide a faithful recounting of a grim and necessary business. It is a theory that joins Underground Railroad chroniclers both with antebellum novelist Harriet Beecher Stowe and Lydia Maria Child, who insisted on the close factual parallelism of their fictions, with the post-war journalist novelists and the school of William Dean Howells. As a critic, June Howard observes, antebellum abolitionist fiction enlisted life detail and journalistic reports as the data of sympathy. Realist and naturalist fiction relied on observational writings to create, quote, the self-sufficient authority of fact, end quote. Underground Railroad distinguished itself from antebellum abolitionist focus on the salvation of the slave, however, and aligns itself more with the later realist naturalist concern with the lives of immigrants, servants, industrial and farm workers, impoverished urban slum dwellers, prostitutes, the unemployed, and the bottom strata of society. These were the classes that most fugitives would join in the North, even if Still does not extend the time frame of his reportage to encompass much of the subsequent histories of fugitives. Factuality in Underground Railroad centered on report of a liberational process, and post-emancipation afterlife was not within its full descriptive ambit. Unlike the sentimental anti-slavery novel, which pursues emotional effect to achieve its arguments, Still's narratorial voice keeps trauma at a distance in order to maintain its version of neutral realism. For Still, strenuous assertion of factuality becomes of paramount value And yet denial of literariness arrives coupled together with purposes of social exposition. Artless stories, quote Marx, have their own artfulness, whatever the denial. Narrative color defies narrators that disown it. Still's refusal of literature and adamant literalism communicate his insistence that the work of this volume will be to expose the human trauma and tragedy he witnessed, and that the inflationary artifices of popular romance style contradict the purposes of credible testimony. A moral purpose lies in this declarative embrace of prosaic witness, for in this narrative logic, descriptive restraint, redolent with masculine self-control, preserves memory and shields it from the elaborations of romance. Neither do the many constituent narratives form a purely sociological narrative that proceeds by separating objects of knowledge from neutral observer, since Still writes as an activist and, on nearly all occasions reported, a participant in events. The business of the Fugitive Slave Compendium, in the eyes of Still and his now aging abolitionist contributors and supporters, was testimony and not entertainment. In moments, it does have moments of humor, irony, role reversal, and relief, but these are incidental to the purposes of preserving testimony. For Still, who was arrested and jailed once and several more times faced arrest, there is a crucial seriousness and life-threatening risk to the business of escaping slavery and harboring fugitive slaves, one that admitted of no perceived narrative license. He emphasizes, again, the factuality and historicity of the volume and of its service as a means of preserving knowledge of its horrors before, quote, living witnesses to the truth of these records will cease to bring vividly to mind the hour and circumstances when, for the first time, they were led to resort to this road to escape the barbarism of slavery, end quote. To recreate vivid memory, the fear and consequences of failure in assisting fugitives to escape, with seizure and re-enslavement for fugitives, together with potential prison and financial ruin from civil judgments against those who aided them, would have to become palpable to the compendium's readers. The purposes of exercising close narrative control over emotions, then, lies in inspiring readers to assume the burden of fear involved in identification with fugitives in mid-flight, despair at being caught, relief and triumph over escape accomplished, and the profoundly difficult emotions of recognizing that family and friends remained in slavery. For Still, the question, quote, what must these fugitives have been feeling, is one left to fugitives, to readers, and to their common bond within the text. There is a final, crucial bond that Still creates throughout his project, a recognition that this volume represents a community and its struggle against the historical traumas inflicted by slavery. While Underground Railroad had a single compiler or general editor, it had a multiplicity of contributors, the fugitives. Publication of their narratives within the covers of a single volume reconstituted the multiple passages northwards of individual fugitives into a new community, located in the memory of a common experience. These multiple participations, direct and indirect, in creating Underground Railroad are one reason the volume is far more than a chronology or a chronometric narrative of escapes from slavery. Given the many hundreds of fugitive stories that the book recounts, the African American readership that had kinship relations or personal knowledge of these fugitives extended into the many thousands. If readers did not have personal knowledge of one of the fugitive cases recorded, then they had knowledge of similar cases unrecorded. The circle expands to tens and hundreds of thousands, I should say. Readers, presumably some of the same fugitives aided by the General Vigilance Committee or other committees, or family and friends of the former fugitives, shared an expanded view of escape from slavery. Past experiences became current and prospective community. To enter extensively into individual trauma is to raise questions of narrative justice and privacy. Why are not equal efforts made to render all traumas, and in so doing, will not intrusive trespass do injustice towards the suffering of many? If Still rejects stylistic artfulness and literariness as embroidery that threatens a claim on absolute and verifiable historicity, then the cumulative emotional penetrations of its fugitive escape stories shift the book away from Still's effort to establish it as documentary. This contest between emotional content and stylistic and genre conventions generates the constantly variable and shifting reading practices the text demands. As readers encounter a series of brief narratives, as we choose and read passages, we encounter underground Philadelphia as the space of trauma and its release. William Still can give us the facts, but in so doing, he leaves us the work of imagining and understanding. Thank you very much.